Welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, and we come to you live for another episode of the show where we answer all of the questions on cricket that someone actually asked. Let's start with the Patreon. Remember, you can find us at patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. And if you're on the live now on YouTube, the best way to support us is obviously by sending a a super chat if you want us to answer a question. But I'll see if there's anything in the group at the end, and I can take them from there. But a big thanks to everyone who's with us again. And first question is from Ben, who says, the average height of great batters is short. Do you think with greater emphasis on power, range, and aggression, the average height of batters will go up over time, potentially as players get into sides like T20? So I think we've already started to see the heights go up, and I think we actually saw them go up a long time ago. My guess is it's when uncovered wickets change, if we're being very, very honest here. I think uncovered wickets fell apart a little bit more and, kept as low. It wasn't as hard. So as we started to see wickets get covered, we actually started to see batters get taller naturally. If you go back to the history of cricket, the ball ran along the ground. So you needed shorter batters. And for up until World War II, you probably still needed shorter batters. And then afterwards, we start to see, Clive Lloyd come through. Is it Ted Dexter or Peter May? One of them is quite tall, I think, anyway. We start to see those players come through consistently, which we don't see all that much in the early part of cricket. So, there's a real movement towards that sort of thing that comes in. And I think it's more to do with the pitches than anything else. But then, as the other, that different things are going to evolve cricket. And I do think there is an advantage to being a tall batter. I was told by a lot of batters that they thought that the reason everyone was short was more to do with the fact that it's about hand-eye coordination, and it's easier to have hand-eye coordination when you're shorter. I'm not sure if that is as prevailing a thought now as it once was. James says, is George, Ron, Dean Headley the only example of one family have test players from three consecutive generations? Oh, very good. What about the Khan family in cricket? I might need to Google that one off the top of my head. There's so many of them. What have we got? Imran Khan, if I start with him, what will I get here? Probably not, because of the generation that he came in. So yeah, I know there's, I'm trying to think, was there, it's Majid Khan is the one we want, actually, isn't it? It's not Imran. So Majid Khan's father played Test cricket and his son played Test cricket. Is that right? So I think they're the two families, at the top of my head. Yeah. Jaheen Gakkar played for India. That's right. I'm trying to work that out. There's so many Khans that I get them all confused. But Majid Khan, who played, 60, 65 matches for Pakistan. So his son is Buzzard Khan, who's the commentator, and his grandfather played, and Buzzard Khan's grandfather played for India not many times, I think maybe three or four times. And then, of course, the Headleys, as you said, is the other one there, James. They're the only two three-generation test players I know of. There are three generations, I believe, in other ways. I think there's three generations of New Zealand cricketers, but it's not Test, because is it Amelia Kerr? Or maybe her father didn't play. But I know that there are three generations when you look at men's and women's combined, but I don't think it's ever been three generations of Test cricket. It's been three generations of international. And I think if you go back to before we started saying that, countries like Ireland, their games were ODIs. I think it's Ireland or Scotland, but I'm pretty sure it's Ireland that might have three generations as well. I mean, there's about 83 Joyces on their own, so they deserve their own category. Josh says, keepers versus batters, which top six would you rather have? Gilchrist, Watling, Sangakkara, De Villiers, Flower and Ames, or Hobbs, Gavaskar, Bradman, Tendulkar, Lahr, or Richards? But the batsmen need to work out who's keeping. That would be pretty easy. I would pick the batters every time. I'm not really sure why. I mean, you giving me Gilchrist or Watling and Hobbs and Gavaskar, I don't think that's a particularly fair fight with those two there. How hard is it for a non-keeper to keep at test level? It's not ideal, but I don't think it's going to, let's say they drop a few extra catches. You're not getting like brilliant fielding from the other team because they're all wicket keepers, are you? Like, I don't see how those two could ever be comparable. You'd rather pick the six greatest batters in that case, rather than the six greatest wicket keepers. And you could make the you could have Walcott or Sangakkara or Flower in that side, right? Like, you know, you could look at these things completely differently to how you currently have there. So, yeah, I think there's a few other ways of going about that. Niran says, do you have any memories of New Zealand cricketer Daniel Flynn? I was obsessed with him as a teenager and lost sleep when Jimmy Anderson broke his face. Was it Anderson who broke his face? I thought it was Stain. Stain did Craig Cummins, didn't he? Yeah, look, I remember Daniel Flynn. He was a very limited player, is my memory of him. The sort of guy who would sort of nudge the ball around. I thought he had a good good defense. But I don't remember him ever being like the sort of like an elite level batter. I'm just having a look. First class cricket, he averaged 35. Test cricket, he averaged 26. So just kind of a player who was probably, you know, New Zealand was struggling for top level players at that stage. And he got a go. He wasn't bad by any means. I'm trying to remember if there was like a really big score he made. Did he never make 100? I don't remember that. Yeah, so he never made 100. So I suppose that kind of tells you where he ends up. But yeah, just solid, well put together player, but not quite international level, I wouldn't have thought. Tommy Nathan says, do you think in the otherwise dad bods of Warner or Ashwin, there are fast twitch fibers which their wrists or elbows that let them execute their micro skills? I think fast twitch muscle fibers doesn't necessarily mean you look like Usain Bolt. And I think that would be a mistake that a lot of people would, make when coming to think about things from that point of view. I can't remember, but there was a sports science book I was reading once, and it was about someone who grew up in a family of sprinters, but didn't look athletic themselves. But when they timed this person, even though they weren't as athletic, they could still outrun a lot of people who looked like they had fast twitch muscle fibers. So there is a possibility. I would say less so with Ashwin, but with Warne, I think most leg spinners, in order to put the revolutions on the ball that they are trying to put on, like, I'm pretty sure Shane Warne could have bowled at about 80, 85 miles an hour. I don't know if that's the case for Ashwin, but Shahid Afridi, I think, probably could have bowled at 85 to 90 miles per hour. Kumble, I would have thought, would have been over 80 miles an hour as well. We've seen Afridi and Warne actually be clocked to that. I can't think of Kumble ever being clocked bowling really fast. But I know the other guys have, like, you know, Shane Warne tried some medium pacing. He got up to about 128, but wasn't with the real run-up and he wasn't trying. But I'm saying if they fully committed to it, I think he could have got to about 135. 140 maybe not 140 in his case, but Afridi probably I would have thought at more that kind of speed. So yes, I do think that is the case, and that there is certainly an element of that that might be there. I think a lot of wrist spinners can probably, so the amount of revolutions that a wrist spinner puts on the ball is so much more than an off spinner or a finger spinner. And so the reason that we don't always see as much spin is because it's about the top spin and the way that they actually put the revolutions on. But I do think, I always go back to slow balls. If you watch Tamal Mills bowl a back of the hand slow ball, we know he can bowl at 150, 155. But if he bowls a back of the hand slow ball, it's about 95. So if you work that out mathematically, I think you start to understand that if you're bowling wrist spin with a similar amount of revolutions that Tamal Mills is putting on the ball, you then probably are moving your arm really, really quickly. So I think wrist spinners probably do that. Finger spin is a very different kind of art from wrist spin. So I don't know if Ashwin would fit in there. But the other thing I would say is, like, when you look at someone's dad bod, that doesn't define their athleticism, right? Like, there are some people who are really naturally have real natural beach bodies, right? But they're not particularly strong, or they're not particularly fit in some cases. That's why judging people on their fat folds alone it doesn't really work. Ian says, during your work on the next book, The 50 Best Batters, available now on Amazon, it's called The Art of Batting, did you find players who you spoke to who were objective about the quality of teammates or opponents, or was there a natural tendency to overrate those they played with and build a relationship with? No, I think you know, when you just sort of talk to them casually, they will probably start in a way that is very, I'm trying to think of the best way of putting it. When you talk to them casually, they will come up with a theory on, you know, they'll just give you the basic thing. Oh, he's a good player. Once you start to drill down, you know, I mean, I thought Raul Dravid and Sachin Tendulkar was really, really fascinating, right? And I thought Jimmy Adams on Brian Lara was really, really fascinating. You know, I'm trying to think what Ross Taylor said about Kane Williamson as well, whether that was another another interesting one. But when you start to get that sort of stuff, you do realize, oh, wow, like these guys have, they spent so much time thinking about why these guys are good and why they're not good, right? And you know, what makes them great and what, you know, and what their deficiencies are. As long as you can get to that level, people will usually give it to you. It's a place they don't know as much about. They'll just be like, oh, you know, what was his average? And you'll be like, oh, 48 points. I was like, he averaged 48 for 10,000 runs. He's great, isn't he? It's like, okay. Like, I get it. I was looking for slightly more than that, right? But the players, they know, they usually, if you, once you've started a conversation, and this is, you know, for anyone who ever does interviews of any kind, if you can get beyond the superficial and you're talking to someone who's an expert on something about someone else who's an expert, you then have a completely different world. How do you rate this bowling test squad of relatively forgotten early mid-10s Asian players? Shimant Aranga, Pankaj Singh, Rubal Hassan, Ajaz Chima, Sohag Ghazi, Prajan Oja, Dhamika Prasad, Abdul Rahman. Yeah, some really good players. I don't know how I'd rank. I don't really know how to answer that question. Look, Prajan Oja obviously had issues with his action. Did Aranga? I don't think Aranga did. Pankaj Singh, I still think, could have been a really good bowler, but I think he needed to be exposed to Test cricket earlier. I think by the time he got to Test cricket, he was kind of done. Who else have we got here? You know, Abdul Rahman, I think, would still be a really good bowler. So, yeah, I think there's some really good players in there. Swaminathan says, would Lyon be the greatest ever spinner if he's a player from Asia? No, that's not how these things work, right? A, Nathan Lyon can't be a player from Asia because he developed with as an overspin bowler, right? So the reason you know who Nathan Lyon is because of the overspin, right? And that ability to come in. That is something that you can only really learn by being an Australian cricketer, right? So Nathan Lyon's development, like it's like saying, would Ishant Sharma have taken 500 wickets if he'd been Australian? Like, probably not, but it also would have helped him. But would he have developed in the same way? No, right? So I don't know how to answer that, but no. And it's weird that you've got Nathan Lyon rather than Warne. Like, surely Warne is the better option that you would pick there. But no, I don't think that's how those sorts of things work. And I think players develop in very, very different kinds of ways anyway. And I don't think that's naturally how these things go about. I think Nathan Lyon is a more rounded spinner because he didn't play, because he's not Asian. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, that his ability to bowl in multiple places probably comes from the fact that he had to learn that skill in a way that Asian spinners don't. But he also probably isn't as incisive as an Asian spinner, because if you're an Asian spinner, I think you spend most of your life being, like, if you're a great Asian spinner, I should say, I think you spend a lot of your time being looked after is the wrong way of putting it, but the captains know how to handle you. They put the field in the right position. You know, all those sorts of things happen for you. And I think if that's the case, there's absolutely no reason why Nathan Lyon couldn't have, you know, benefited from that sort of thing. But would he have been as good in Australia? Well, clearly not, because Asian spinners generally aren't. Right, so then we'd be having the same conversation about him that we'd be having about someone else. Let us take a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, and we'll be back in a few minutes with more of this kind of thing. If you are following my work, we know that you are a true cricket sadist, and you need your hit every day. And sometimes, sadly, there is actually no cricket to watch. So how about if someone made a very fun game that you could use for the moments when there is no on-field action? Welcome to Hit Wicket, a strategic game of cricket, which isn't about slamming your finger on the screen very fast. You work out what works best based on how cricket actually works. Dot balls lead to wickets, ones and twos to fours and sixes. So there is no way you can bowl a great Yorker every ball or smash three sixes at the beginning of your innings. This is proper cricket. Yet it still has some gaming powers in there as well. Hit Wicket is about playing, but also building and managing your team. You are the batter, bowler, owner, coach, and captain. It's your dream. No ads, just cricket. So download Hit Wicket today, because this is a cricket game made for you and supported by major cricket nerds. All right, welcome back, everyone. Bloody Bugger says, in addition to being an England cricketer, Dennis Compton made 54 appearances for Arsenal. He was very good at things. Are there any other examples of cricketers achieving the highest honours in a different sport for quite modern times? I suppose Susie Bates played in the Olympics for basketball, Elise Perry for football. It's very hard to do now. Shane Warne was a reserves player, wasn't he? So who's the last Aussie rules player? Well, Alex Keith, I suppose, but he never played for Australia. So the last Australian player who played Aussie rules at the top level professional, is that Jamie Siddons, perhaps? And he didn't play many ODIs either. He didn't play many Aussie rules games. It was very common in Australia with football and cricket season to have that. Did Max Walker play Aussie rules football as well? I know Simon O'Donnell definitely did. So there was a few that did that. And obviously, traditionally going back, Keith Miller did as well. There's a few others, especially from Victoria, and a couple in South Australia and Western Australia, I think, as well, that did that. Who else are we missing? There's a guy from Namibia, isn't there, who's represented rugby in Namibian rugby and Namibian cricket in the 2003 World Cup. So I don't know when he played rugby for his nation, but I know that there's a Namibian player there. In modern times, it's just hard because it's not that players, like, obviously there's lots of talk about people like AB de Villiers who could have played in multiple sports and would have been successful in them all. I think there's plenty of situations where that could have happened before and hasn't. Trying to think if there's anyone else I'm missing that's really obvious. There's a couple of cricketers have tried to become golfers, haven't there, and haven't quite made it. Maybe some minor league baseball type stuff as well. Traditionally it was very common. But as cricket has got more professional, I think it would be very rare for women to have it. So Susie Bates and Elise Perry might be two of the last women to have it. Oh, actually, there is a women's cricketer footballer who played for Australia. It was the opening batter, or maybe batter number three in the 2012 World Cup, whose name I've forgotten. But she played for Collingwood in Aussie Rules and then played Big Bash when the Women's Big Bash. So she was a professional in two different leagues at the same time. It has happened, but it's not a particularly common thing, all things considered. All right. Ben says, cricket is easily the worst major sport for using social media. I don't disagree with you, but I'm sure there's other bad ones. As a game, we should be flooding the internet with clips, shorts, reels, etc., instead of currently where boards are doing the opposite and fighting against usage of their clips and images. I know this is something you've mentioned before. Have you noticed any change in this area recently? I think they got worse. I think it's got a lot worse. I think during the 2003 World Cup, the ICC did a deal with, I want to say, Facebook, which meant that they didn't put many clips up on Twitter or on YouTube. God, what a missed opportunity that is. It was great for our channel because people kept coming to our channel for clips, but it was terrible for cricket. And yeah, I see this again and again. I've talked to them. I've told them. It's just idiocy, right? I think in this day and age, if you look at the way that the market works in social media, short clips are a way you can make a little bit of money, right? No doubt about that. But when I'm selling stuff on this channel or the main YouTube channel, right, or on our podcast or whatever, I don't care how many small clips I put out there that I can't really monetize. I can't really monetize the 1 minute clips all that much, right? And so we're doing them for free and they cost me money. And I'm doing them for free. But the way I'm looking at it is, the more people who go to those clips, the more people that will eventually come to the major channel. right? It's as simple as that. Could I hold them back? Could I do something else? Yes, definitely, right? There are other ways to market that I could do it. But that's just a goal, a free goal for me, right? And sports works exactly the same way. I remember, this is like over a decade ago, my friend Sam Collins I think Kagiso Rabada had taken a 5-wicket hole somewhere. And like, he'd missed the 5-wicket hole and he'd also missed, I don't know, maybe whichever Premier League footballer had done something incredible. And he's like, I can go online and I can see this Premier League footballer over and over again and I can't find Rabada's hole. It's embarrassing what the cricket boards do. Honestly, it's absolutely embarrassing for our game how badly they promote our sport online. They should all be ashamed of themselves. And this isn't a new thing either. It's really important that everyone knows this, that in 1996, CricInfo was offered to the cricket boards for free. And they didn't want to be involved with the fans then. They don't want to give the fans content now, right? It's an embarrassment for our sport, and it's been going on for so long. And I mean, I don't know. It frustrates me. It frustrates me as a fan. Frustrates me as someone in the media. It frustrates me as someone in content creation. Like in every different aspect of my life, I can't just go online. If something's happened in a game, and I want to show my son the 24 balls that Vernon Philander has just bowled, because I think like he'll really get into it and he'll understand a lot about cricket. I can't show him that. Right? And yet I can go on to the NBA app and I can go to the highlights for almost any single player. Like they don't even make it so you can pay for it. They just don't do it. Half of these boards run, whether it's MV Play or one of the other, you know, versions of MV Play, they all have it available to them. There is no reason why every time a great player makes 100, we don't have every single ball that they're faced in a 4-minute video clip. There's no reason not to do that. There is no reason to hold that back and sell it to some internet company who doesn't even get that many hits anyway, right? It's a disgrace the way cricket fans are treated online when they're the ones who make the money for these cricket boards in the first place. But forget that. Forget how the cricket fans are treated. It's a disgrace to the game of cricket that we are not actually trying to sell it to anyone who isn't already a hardcore fan of it. What is the point of that? And it's not just about the rights. You could go through TV package deals and ads and partners. Every single way that cricket is run in a way that is not to get more fans. It's not to grow the game of cricket. Anyway, so sick and tired of it. Ali says, what are the tips and tricks that players do technically to increase their power hitting? Increased bat swing, different shot selection, different stances. Essentially, what makes sixes go long and often. So range hitting is one of the best ones because, you know, then a player just feels comfortable smacking the ball as far as possible, as often as possible, right? So I think range hitting is a really, really big part of how people have gone on to make more runs. Hit the ball further. Understanding the swing. If you look at that sort of Joss Butler type of swing, we used to have a very traditional cricket swing. And we now have something that's much more like a golf swing. That's changed. Batters, when they used to want to hit the ball further, would go and pump the weights, right? Whereas now it's about core and understanding how to engage the core, which is, again, goes through all the different sports that have similar sorts of things. Lighter bats is a part of it, having the ability to swing the bat harder or being strong enough to be able to swing a heavier bat. But generally, if someone wants to score quicker, what they would normally do is they would probably go to a section in their game that they're already doing quite well and kind of, I don't know the best way of putting this, but upskill it. So if you're really good at cutting, you will cut everything, right? And that's a thing that we see quite a lot in modern professional cricket now, which is players doing that. So a lot of the power hitting isn't really power hitting, I don't think, anymore. I think what we see more often is players score at a quicker rate because they're maximizing their different shots that they're already very good at. So, being able to cut off middle stump and all those sorts of things. But yeah, the power stuff, it's Backing yourself, knowing how far you can hit the ball, consistently hitting the ball at that length. All these things matter. Confidence, having your team say that's what you're in the side to do. So hit the ball hard. Ruger says, we don't often see right arm paces bowling around the wicket to right-handed batters or left arm to left hand without it being a short ball strategy. However, wouldn't there be some batters for whom bowling full but angling away from them would actually be effective in the same way that left arm bowlers typically angle it across righties? Okay, so the big difference here is the angle is so full on that what it really does is it almost gives you a free hit, whereas a left-arm bowler doesn't really give you a free hit. If the left-arm bowler is still coming from relatively close to the stumps, there is an element there of the ball being close enough that you can play that shot too. And so I think it is a little bit different. The other element is that if you're bowling around the wicket as a right-hander to a right-hander, you're taking away bold and LBW. Whereas again, left-handers are not taking away bold and LBW. So you're basically bowling for two things: the nick behind, as you've just said there, and the short ball strategy of like kind of tucking them up and coming behind them, I suppose is the best way of looking at it. If you have a traditional two-eyed stance, right? The ball's sort of coming at you from slightly behind your eyes. There aren't that many other ways to be dismissed. You can kind of just stand in front of your stumps. Bowling full and wide in that situation, you're only bowling with angle. It's probably very hard to get any swing from that kind of position. And I think more often than not, you're probably just, unless there's a batter who just cannot hit really full and wide balls, it doesn't work. I do think it's something that maybe should be used more often as a defensive tactic with a stacked offside field and like, you know, three slips or something, and the way that left-handers use it. But overall, I don't think it's a very good strategy. And I can't think of many players who don't like full and wide balls, like realistically, especially with that kind of angle. William says, who are these end of September England white ball games for? The players look like they don't really care. Fans have no enthusiasm. Stadiums are half full. Just got to fit them in somewhere, man. That's, you know, I don't know if there's a really good reason, why these things exist or anything. But yeah, I certainly don't have a great example of that. All right, I don't have a great answer for that. I mean, they play bilateral. Be funny. They're probably for Sky. And Sky would probably prefer them to be at a different part of the year as well. All right, I'll have a quick break here and we'll be back in a moment with more of the Wagon Wheel.
A lot of people complain that I'm not a former cricketer and so that I don't really know the game. Well, you know what they can't claim? Then I don't know desks. I've been using desks for years. I'm a collector of desks, old and new, and I'm sitting on a new one right now. I'm the Don Bradman of sitting at desks. So when I tell you that the E7 Pro next generation height adjustable desk from FlexiSpot is legit, this is like Michael Jordan talking to you about sneakers. This desk holds 160 kilograms. It is as stable as anything I've ever seen, and it has under desk cable management. But really, the main skill here is that this desk rises and falls at the push of a button, and it moves super quick. And it has so many settings that remember your favorite heights. It really does it all. And I could not recommend the E7 Pro from FlexiSpot anymore. Even though I am currently sitting on one of FlexiSpot's BS12 Pro multifunctional, adjustable, upgraded fabric, ergonomic chairs. My butts and computer have never been happier than when using one of FlexiSpot's products. So get over to their page right now for big savings.
All right, welcome back. Oh, I've still got William's question up, don't I? Welcome back to the Wagon Wheel. And let's have a look who we have next. Jessica says, according to Simon Hughes, the calls for modernizing English cricket began in earnest in the 1920s. Abolishing amateurs, shortening the boundaries. Yeah, there was lots of things going on there. But a lot of these reforms weren't put in practice till the 60s, 40 years later. Would you say that English cricket administrators are still this conservative and slow, or have they been getting better in more recent generations? The best one is overarm bowling, right? So overarm bowling, late 1700s and doesn't become legal for like 60 or 70 years. And one of the reasons that they didn't want to do that is because it meant that cricket became a more athletically driven game. And so the older guys who ran the game wouldn't be able to handle fast bowling, right? So there's always a reason why these things exist, when you go through it. It's weird to say that England is still conservative and slow. I mean, T20 cricket was theirs, but they did allow everyone else to go and do it better. So there is, you can kind of say that they got it right and wrong at the same time. I think modern English cricket as a complete unit is probably the most professional situation. So levels of analysis, levels of sports science and everything else. I think Australian cricket has a lot of good things in it. I'm not sure that everything in Australia is quite at the level that English cricket is at the moment. So there's something else that England is leading the pack on. So I think there's a couple of things there. But the 100 exists because cricket in the 1970s, 1960s was not the level of football, but like an equivalent to football. And by the 2000s, it was well behind as the second sport, right? So, there are ways to look at it as progressive and there are ways to look at it as conservative. But yeah, I think the people who've run it are the issue, right? And I don't mean that in a, bash the posh kind of way, but like there's been conservative people that have run cricket and they are conservative in their politics. They come from inherited wealth in many cases and inherited titles. And so those are not the sorts of people who generally want to upset the apple cart, right? Like they want it to continue to go the same way. There's a big difference between Edgbaston and Lords. And that's not accidental. Jessica says, you wrote about Murali. His victims didn't come one at a time, but in big hauls, like a fisherman using a net instead of a line. That's not bad. I think I've used that before, actually. I think I've used that since. I don't remember many of my lines, but that one seems good. So if Murali kept taking all the huge bags of wickets for himself, then are we actually able to objectively analyze the skills and qualities of his spin bowling partners, Kumar Dhanasinghe and Upal Chandana? Look, think about it this way. If you are bowling with Fazal Mahmood, Richard Hadley, or Murali, and those are three of the great sort of single wicket takers in the history of Test cricket, right? Those are guys who are just absolutely incredible at taking wickets at a much higher rate per game than other bowlers did. We've had some others as well. Clary Grimmett might be another one, I think, off the top of my head. At a certain point, don't you have to look at the fact that these bowlers at the other end are bowling two fresh batters over and over again? Right? Like, I don't think there's a way of talking around that. Like, they had wickets coming and they had the ability to take wickets themselves and they didn't take them. So, yeah, I do think there's plenty of chance. I think we can pretty accurately look at those bowlers and be like, yeah, they were fine, but they obviously weren't, top tier level international bowlers. We haven't done that one. Nadika says, you can pick one all-rounder in the history to do a Shohei Ohtani. In other words, focus on one skill. Which all-rounder would you most want to see what they could do? Shohei Ohtani 2024. In other words, focus on one skill. Isn't Shohei Ohtani doing both? Didn't he just do a 50-50 thing? Who would be the all-rounder? I suppose it's Sobers. Sobers averages, I should know this off the top of my head, but I think Sobers averages something like, let's have a look here. Sobers averages 72 from 14 games from batting at first drop. And he averages, that's including a 365, of course. But then at second drop, he averages 63.75. So when he comes down the order, his average goes down. So when he bats at number five and number six, it's 59 and 53. So if Sobers had batted up the order and just been a specialist batter, I think he has which is ridiculous to say, I think he probably ends up with an even higher batting average. So what was he, 57.8? I think it's higher again if he does that. I can't imagine that bowling the amount of overs he bowled a game, which is, I think, the same as Jimmy Anderson, didn't affect his batting. Whereas Callis bowls not about, 60% of the overs that Sobers bowled? There were periods when Callis bowled more, but Callis was never like a first choice bowler in that lineup, right? I'd be really interested to see how Botham and Keith Miller had gone if they were just specialist batters, because I think they had so much untapped potential as a batter. Trying to think if there's anyone else. Yeah, I think everyone else is. I think those are the ones I'm probably most interested in off the top of my head. This is brought to you by HitWicket, the cricket game that has playing and strategy all in your pocket. Adityan says, have you considered the role of day watchman? Essentially send someone out Aksha or Ash at the start of a day when there is way too much moisture and the ball nips a lot. Even if they face half an hour, there's a win for the full batters to come when the pitch eases out and makes merry. Yes, I think my main issue with that is if the conditions are too hard for a top order batter, why do you think a number 7 or number 8 are going to do better on them? So I think this is the kind of thing that for me works the opposite the way that people think it would work. And there's no way of proving this, of course. But this is my Chris Wokes at number 3 theory, which it's like, Chris Wokes is averaging 35 batting at number 7 and 8. We should bat him at number 3. And it's like, yeah, but he might average 15 if he bats at number 3. Because that's the hardest, that's the second hardest place to bat other than open in the batting. And so if you're saying that it's so hard to go out there and there's moisture in that pitch, do you really want to send out the guys who aren't as good at those skills? Now, you might have an Andy McBryne type player, right? That's when it gets fascinating because I think Andy McBryne is specifically set up to probably go and play the new ball really well, far better than he is to bat at number 7 or number 8, being honest. But that's because that's what his skill set is. Whereas in Ashwin and Akshar's case, that's not their skill set. Their skill set is probably playing spin, right? That's probably where they're at their best against batting. And in Akshar's case, in both their case, probably when the ball's a little bit more soft. So you have to factor in when they are going up the order, right? Like when they have made their runs. Oh, James, off the long run here. Barry Richards was included in many all-time 11s on the basis of his 4th test matches and 5 super tests. Yeah, so what's the average? About 60-something in those 9 games. And he obviously dominated first-class cricket in South Africa, England, and Australia. Can you think about any other players who could pass the Barry Richards test? Also be considered an all-time great based on their first 4 tests, another 5 tests some 8 years later, and their domestic record. Of course, this assumes that World Series cricket to be the equivalent it definitely was the level of test cricket. I don't know, because I think that's a really, really hard one. I don't think, I'm not sure that the first 4 tests matter all that much in Barry Richards' record. When you hear the stories, it's more, was it the time he makes 300 out of 500 runs or something for South Australia? It's the time he batted with Viv Richards and Gordon Greenidge, who were both in their peaks, and he was probably a little bit past his, and he hadn't played, as much proper cricket as he should have, and he still outshone both of them. Right. Against a top attack again. That was one of the World Series cricket ones you're talking about. I think it's the many times he went out on, ridiculously green wickets and smashed everyone everywhere in county games or, dominated Shield cricket in a way that imports had never dominated Shield cricket before and everything else. So I think it's the overall thing. I don't think the important thing here is the 4 tests at the front and the 4 tests at the end. The player that comes to mind is there's a bunch of players that don't get the chance. I would have to go through everyone's record and work out who did really well at the start and then who did really well later on. I don't think that is particularly easy to do. I think you've got a player like Stewie Dempster from New Zealand, who in his first 10 tests averages 65 and then has a record of averaging about 45 in first-class cricket outside of that. I think it's fair to say in his situation that we probably saw the absolute best of him in test cricket and that he was still a great player because, averaging 45 over 184 first class games is still pretty good. But he was a little bit flattered by that start. You've got, I'm going to forget which VJ I want to look up. It's not Merchant, is it? It's Malia I want to look up. It is VJ Merchant. So VJ Merchant plays 10 games. So we know he averages 71 in first-class cricket. And we know how, obviously, he was a next-level talent. And in 10 test matches, again, he averages 47. So I would probably put him more on that level of Barry Richards than anyone else. But someone recently said that people overestimate Barry Richards and then someone like Vijay Murjan is someone that doesn't get that kind of level. I think the one difference between the two of them is the two different eras in which they managed to dominate. So because we know that Barry Richards was dominating in the 60s, and then he was still dominating even more so a decade later when he came back. And then the other thing that you have with Barry Richards is it's three different first-class systems that he dominates. So if you look at Vijay's stats, it's really India and England. And his England numbers are really, really good, by the way. So he's a player who I would say should be on that similar level. It wasn't in the TV era, which is one huge problem. So many people have seen Barry Richards play in one of those three countries, right? That's a huge difference between that and Vijay Murjan and Stewie Dempster. And Martin Donnelly might be another one that you might put up there as well. So there are other players with small records that we know are definitely greats at one level or another, but they're not fully tested, so we don't know all the way through how good they were. And Barry Richards happens to be the one that is on TV. But to answer your other question, James, it's just impossible for me to remember someone who was good in their first four games and then had like 7 or 8 games in the middle of their career and then a really strong first-class record. So I don't think there really is another Barry Richards specifically because of the TV element and the three first-class parts of it. But I do think Martin Donnelly, Stu Dempster, and Vijay Murjan are three guys that I'd be really, really interested. You know, like, I don't know, if you could time travel and just have a look at that and just take them to random places during their career. I think that'd be really, really fascinating as well. But I think they were, if I was ranking them, I still think Barry Richards and Murjan are at the top. But I think that Donnelly and Stu Dempster are really, really high as well. But they're like, no one, like Murjan at least gets mentioned sometimes. Donnelly and Dempster, it's like, it's literally I'm the only person left mentioning them regularly. Missed one. Josh says, in past episodes, you've talked about the value of having a specialist keeper like Prasanna Jayawardena compared to a batter like Flower. Lawrence and Tendulkar are both better batsmen than Ponting. Does Ponting's elite fielding make him a more valuable player? The issue here is we don't know because we don't keep any numbers on that. So I can say that Prasanna Jayawardena is more value with the gloves than Flower. Whether he's 20 runs more per game or per innings, I don't know. But what I do know is a wicketkeeper takes the ball an awful lot more than a fielder like Ponting does. So, and then you also, is this Ponting the slip fielder or is this Ponting cover and point fielder? How many times do they field a game? How many runs do they save? We're not counting any of that. So I couldn't tell you. And you know, Lara wasn't a bad slipper from memory. And Tendulkar was a very highly skillful fielder, but he probably wasn't in outside of when he was like short-legged stuff. I don't think he was in really important positions to, you know, he wasn't in run-saving or catching positions all that much. So you would probably have Lara and Ponting's fielding more important. But how many times does the ball go to them per game? That's the only way to be able to really answer that question, Josh. I think because of that reason, it's not a particularly easy one to have a look at. Swami Nathan says, would Bumrah's late release have any effect on batters like Hayden and KP, who themselves shorten the pitch by walking down? Every batter it would have an impact on because he's shortening the pitch by half a meter, right? 40 centimeters or whatever it is. So it doesn't really matter if you're those guys or not. Every player has a problem with it. I would say he would be the hardest to come down to. I'm trying to think of who else would be hard to come down the wicket to. I suppose really tall bowlers are as well, aren't they? Sort of, you know, that Garner and Jameson are probably two other players that, you know, just once you're releasing the ball from that height, Jacob Oram, even at a slower pace, it's very hard to come down the wicket to those sorts of guys. But if they're a little bit slower, you can still do it and just try and flat bat them. So maybe Garner and Jameson become a little bit tougher in that sort of situation. But you can kind of come down to anyone. You're not coming down the wicket really. Players come down the wicket for about two or three different reasons, I think, overall. There's people who just come down to slog. They probably weren't going to do particularly all that much well to begin with. There's players who come down to change the length of the pitch, of the ball. So literally by coming down the wicket, it makes it much harder for the bowler to hit their normal length. So KP is probably a very good example of that. And there are bowlers who come down to change, batters who come down the wicket to change the bowler's plans, which is probably more what Hayden did. So could that work against Bumrah? We haven't seen anyone do it, but it's kind of gone out of the game, that style of batting anyway. So we now get the more Ollie Pope version. And I thought there were times at which, you know, that version worked okay. I can't remember if, you know, what Ollie Pope's record was against Bumrah specifically in that Ashes, in the, what was it? The England, India series. But there is an element of that's what you would try and do. But yeah, I mean, it's, I remember looking at England and realizing how much they were using coming down the crease, either using their feet or batting out of their crease. And when I looked at it, it was still about 25% of the time. And that's enough to completely stuff up the lines and the lengths of the opposition bowler. But they, even they know that you can't do it all the time because you are literally giving the bowler a huge advantage. All right, let us have another a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel podcast. And we will be back in a minute for questions from the room. NV Play helped me produce this content. For detailed performance breakdowns using their advanced technology when it comes to cricket and data, reach out to them today. All right, welcome back to the Wagon Wheel. Nikhil says, even if Root overtakes Sachin, will he really be better than Kohli and Smith, who have had more impact, tough pitch, game-turning innings versus the top teams? Root's been great, but not more impactful. Hasn't he? I agree with that all that much. I don't really care where he ends up in the list because it's just one thing that I look at. Like, it's one of 10 things. Let's say Williamson ends up playing longer than either of those other three guys. Like, I would look on that more favorably than I would him scoring an extra 4,000 runs. Although there is an element of just having to go out and score those runs. Like, I don't want to say that's not there, but it's like he has an availability route that other players don't. But I don't know about this impactful thing. I don't think I agree with that at all. I think Root's a distance behind Smith, but who knows what the next 4 years, if he goes on to beat Sachin's record, my assumption is he's going to be averaging high 40s, low 50s into his early 40s, right? That stage, then yeah, of course we have to, longevity, because playing is a massive part then, right? Part of Sachin's thing is the longevity part of it. And then the other side of that is, at the moment, he's probably gone past Virat Kohli as a player, as a batter, I should say, just because he's had more great years. So I don't really get your point, to be honest, there. But I don't think the Sachin part of it is the bit that I'm particularly as enamored with. That's not how I would look at those things. Nicholas says, role of AQI in poor broadcast quality in Asia. AQI? Okay. Broadcast quality. Why? Oh, okay. Oh, air quality. Sorry, I was like, I don't know if it affects broadcast quality. I've always thought that, I've never known how to explain this, but I would love to write about it. But it certainly felt like this was the case back when I was younger. And it still happens a little bit now that this, like, every ground and, well, certainly every cricket's country, it just looked different. And I would assume that's air quality, that's, you know, the amount of dirt or the amount of sand from the ground, how green the grass is, you know, all, you know, how good the cameras is and everything. But as someone who grew up, like, I looked at it that way. I've never really looked at the cameras and everything. I would assume, and I say this as a camera person, but not as a, like, a TV camera person or anything, but, you know, I would assume that on the really long lens stuff and the, you know, the really expensive stuff, that the air not being quite as clear will have a haziness to it. But there's two ways of looking at that, because as a kid growing up, that was my favorite cricket to look at, was like Asian cricket and West Indian cricket, because they looked like they had this kind of haze about them. And if you look at the great photography of sports, it was in the days when people smoked, right? That sort of smoky nature. So maybe there's a part of that there. But yeah, I don't really know. I think Asia in general is probably more pushing towards streaming and everything else. And so the quality is a different thing. Whereas, you know,
especially being in Australia, but I've noticed a little bit in England as well. Like, there's just so much talk about UHD and, you know, how many pixels, everything. Do you know, it feels like that's a really, like all my dad's friends, I still hear, and, you know, and my uncle and people like that, I still hear them talk about all that sort of stuff. Whereas I don't know if that's as common in other places. So in places where that matters, the camera, and it's, if you look at cricket visuals have been pushed forward by Australia traditionally, right? You know, Kerry Packer and that move and that Channel 9, everyone was trying to catch up to Channel 9 for a long period of time. You know, a lot of the toys and the little things that they use and all these things that happen all come out of that. So I think there's an element there, but yeah, I don't know. Madhav says, what are your best top three openers of all time and why? Mine are Sachin, Rohit. Wait a minute. You said your best three and then you picked four. You can't have four if you've asked someone to pick three. What is this? You've got Sachin, Rohit, Gilly and Jayasuriya. Look, I haven't looked into it, if I'm being honest. Like, it's just not something off the top of my head. I would assume Sachin would be on the list. Jayasuriya is a really interesting one. I'd like to have another look at Sehwag's numbers because I remember him as being great. Obviously, Gilly would be up there. I'm trying to think if there's anyone old. Probably not with opening, is there? Haynes and Marsh don't really translate in a way like Viv Richards does. Yeah, and Rohit is up there as well. But I would have to have a look at that. But yes, if you're going to ask me for my top three, you have to do your top three. You can't pick four. Agro says, has India Gen Z test batters gone past old school Pujara ways by not trusting their defense enough, becoming flamboyant since the advent of IPL? We'll be doing a video on this soon. But if you batters get bold and go LBW, get bold less in test cricket now than they ever have before in this generation. If everyone's technique is so shit, why aren't batters getting bowled more often than ever before? Like, as a question, I would like all these people who tell me that the techniques have gone, go and watch old players play. I watch a lot of old players play. They have batshit crazy techniques, right? And you watch them and they get bowled and they get leading edges and they're pushing a balls outside off stump. I think there's some kind of like, I don't know, something our uncles or our grandparents taught us about old cricket. It's like, I've seen the footage. They play terrible shots, these old batters. Again and again. You don't get many Boycotts and Gavaskers. And do you know how I know that? Because we know who they are, right? You get a lot more Trevor Franklins. Look up Trevor Franklin. I can't even say his name. From New Zealand. It's just a different kind of player. I think, if you look at Watling and you look at Pujara, what you are looking at there are players with impeccable skills at playing defensive shots. And so that is where they build their strength, right? And Rahul Dravid had that, right? And you can go through history and you get a few players. Most players don't build their success through defensive shots, right? So Alistair Cook, his strike rate in Test cricket was like 47. Scored it like three runs and over, right? His ability was patience, waiting for the right ball and turning it away. But his actual defensive shots, when you look at them, a little bit ropey at times, right? We're going to get defensive players again. We've gone through a period in the last couple of years of being really attacking. A couple of years ago, strike rates went down. Why? I never got any comments about it. But strike rates went down in Test cricket. So I actually think now players are playing to their strengths. Right. And so I don't think they're being more flamboyant. And it's got nothing to do with the IPL because this is happening everywhere. Rahul says, are there fewer wrist spinners around a test cricket today than any other point? There wasn't a lot of wrist spinners in the 70s and 80s, off the top of my head. There was a lot of finger spinner at that point. I would say, when was the last wrist spinner between Warne and Yasir Shah, trying to think if there were many in there.
So no, I think a big part of it is DRS. I think DRS favors finger spin. And I think now that players are quicker and more agile, so they can use their feet more, and wrist spin is a little bit slower. And then the third part of that is that wrist spin pays the most money if you play in T20 cricket. So there is an element, of course, that you would naturally go across there and play. And that's a slightly different form of bowling, right? So I think there's a few small parts there. Rajiv says, what do you think about the morality of promoting betting, gambling in sports? It often exposes younger and thus more vulnerable populations to something which can develop into a crippling addiction. The 100 has snacks and stuff on the front of their shirts when the diets of English people are not particularly good. Cricket Australia has KFC. As someone who's been, so let me tell you the things I've been addicted to in my life. Not really alcohol, but kind of like I had some moments at times where I had some issues with alcohol. Fast food, absolutely addicted to it. You know, if you can find any old photos of me on the internet, like I've lost 50 kilos, right? Fast food, absolutely addicted to. And I, again, a bit like alcohol, I had a little problem with gambling at one stage in my life, but it was more to do with other things in my life, right? So I've been addicted to all three. The ones that have been pushed to me the most by sports have been fast food, right? With a little bit of alcohol inside, I think that's fair. But mostly in this period of my life, well, you know, sorry, in my teens and 20s, it was probably more fast food than alcohol, although alcohol played a part as well. I didn't get addicted to those things because of the advertising, but being in that situation, certainly it was a part of it. Like if we're going to ban everything that's bad from advertising, which we might get to, right? Like, When we grew up, we had smoking ads. Anyone who's older than 30 probably grew up with sporting ads. I mean, go and check the names of the first World Cups, right? Benson and Hedges World Cup. And yet I've never smoked in my life, right? Gambling was actually always separated from cricket. But I have always gambled. Or not always gambled, but I've gambled quite consistently. I get the idea of not having any of those things on the broadcasts. I really do. But it would never, I don't think it would ever go far enough for the things that I think need to be banned, right? Do you know what I mean? There's so many things that I think should be banned from advertising. If you watch cricket in the UK, there's a lot of penis pills. I don't think kids should be watching cricket, and I'm not a prude. Like, I've got no problem with sexual adverts, but penis pills, I don't know, it just seems really weird. Right. If you're trying to get a younger audience involved in the game. So I think there's heaps of things. So that's on the broadcast side of things. I think we need to be a lot more mature when it comes to sports gambling in the writing space, the content creation space, maybe not radio, because that would be like TV broadcasting. The biggest industry in cricket is sports gambling. I don't think, is gambling. It's bigger than any other thing. It makes more money than anything else does in cricket. And I don't think hiding it behind and not talking about it and not being smart about it is helping. And it's one of the reasons that I started talking about it on this channel, because I felt like people needed to actually learn some stuff about it rather than, there's no prohibition that works with gambling. We know that. Americans have been gambling for generations. Indians have been gambling for generations. And it's been banned in both those places. So I don't think things that are illegal and that you have to learn about from a dodgy guy down at the local chai shop or some guy in the corner of a pub is a good idea. Because I think generally when you go down that thing, I think actually opening up these sorts of conversations is a lot better. But I do think there's a couple of things I have massive issues with. One is gambling companies are, like cigarette companies and many other companies, absolutely dodgy as hell. Right, you win a couple of times on an account, and they shut the account down. Right, you bet on something because they put the wrong odds up, and some of them won't pay out on it. Right, this whole idea of, like, you know, you see, especially across the Western world, bet responsibly. If you bet responsibly, they will shut your accounts. If you bet correctly, they will shut your accounts. So I do think the industry in total, I think you've got many points, but not. This idea that not advertising gambling, right, matters
it's not how these things work, right? Unfortunately, people are going to gamble on things. I think if we've seen anything from the history of, cricket, people have always gambled on it. And they're gambling on it now at a much higher rate. And yet in many countries, you're not seeing any gambling ads. That isn't changing the amount of money that is gambled in places like India and Pakistan, which is still huge amounts of money. But I do think on the broadcast, I kind of feel like, you know, the sports shouldn't be doing that. But it's a fascinating thing as well, because gambling companies, legal gambling companies, are actually, I wouldn't say the best friend, but one of the best weapons that any sport has in finding out if things are fixed. So from that perspective, I'm like, I really want that to be something that that continues. So how we do these sorts of things. Look, we don't take gambling advertising on this channel so far. So the only thing that we had was My 11 Circle for like 5 episodes a long time ago. My Circle 11. I always forget the name of that place. It's probably why they stopped the sponsorship, which is, of course, it is gambling, but it's called something slightly different, right? But in order for me to build my business correctly, I might have to do a deal with a gambling company in the future. And of course, we talk about gambling on this channel. We work with Cricket 8, which is involved in gambling. Like, I think having grown-up conversations about these things is a lot better than the way that we currently do them. But at the same time, as I'll go back to my original point, I don't know if whether it be, you know, bad foods, whether it be alcohol, whether it be cigarettes, whether it be gambling, whether these are things that, you know, I mean, I'm looking at, what have I got in front of me? USA and Namibia, and I've got DAFA News, you know, in the background, you know, sponsoring that particular thing. I mean, it's right on the ground. We all know what DAFA is, right? Like, it's a betting company. They find ways around it, though, is the other thing that I would say. And, you know, I'm not an expert on Indian culture, but the first time I realized that when I was watching an ad for Kingfisher beer, it was actually an ad for Kingfisher premium water, was one of the most, I just was like, it's so hard to regulate things because companies with money will find a way to do them. So if you look at America, you know, DraftKings Network have just bought like a bunch of podcasts, right? They bought the entire networks, you know, and so that is a betting company, right? And so that is a way they're getting around the fact that I don't think the people on the podcast really, well, the podcast I listen to don't really talk about the odds that much unless they're trying to make a point narratively the way that I do, or the way that, you know, some other places do. But you're listening to a podcast run by a betting company, and there's so much more money in that sort of stuff that I think things like Good Areas or 99.94 or Cricket 8 and all these different things, as they get picked up, cricket.com might be another one. Or, you know, as they get picked up, who's the companies that can afford to do that? I've been trying to get proper funding for my channels, which are flying for years, right? No, everyone tells me no one will invest in cricket content. The one people that will, right, is the gambling industry. Eventually, everything ends up back there. And it's an issue for sports in general, I think, that I don't think the athletes make enough money out of the gambling, if that makes sense. And I wonder if there'll be, you know, ways of doing that. But it's interesting to me that there's so much money in the gambling industry than there is in the actual playing and the professional sport itself, which I think is the bigger issue than anything else that we've talked about here, Rajiv.
NV Play's tools make cricket data accessible to everyone. They assisted me in making this and support many international cricketers access their software on their website for valuable insight.
Nikhil says, 5 test series will accentuate home advantage. How much harder for India to sustain in Australia over 5 tests versus 4 tests? Gideon and Lawler spoke of this 4 years ago post-Gabba. Yes, but also I think in, you know, the last couple of times, I think Australia got tired. So, you know, it's a little bit different now that I think they can lean on their all-rounders a little bit more. But yeah, if you've got a 5-man attack against a 4-man attack, I'd take the 5 tests. Like, you're much less likely to have your bowlers get absolutely exhausted in that situation.
Madhav says, in your views, who plays the sexiest pull shot from the past and current generation as well, and why? I was like Matthew Elliott's one. I know it's not a particularly famous one. There's an innings that Matthew Elliott plays when he bats at number three against South Africa when he was brought back. He wanted to open, but they weren't going to drop Mark Taylor because he was the captain. And the only spot left in was for Elliott to bat at number three. And it got in his head so much that he was hitting a punching bag before he went out. Actually, it wasn't a punching bag. He was hitting the gloves, wasn't he? And when he came out, like, Alan Donald's just like bouncing him at top pace. And Elliott is just playing these sort of graceful pull shots with a really straight bat is what I remember. And they seemed to go like an inch over the umpire's hat, right? And like almost go for six or go for six a couple of times. So I love that. I love the West Indian style of putting your leg up. So Greenwich and Lara, I suppose, are the two most famous versions of that. I've always liked Rohit Sharma's pull shot. You know, they're all slightly different. I remember Greg Blewett was someone who used to pull really straight. And I suppose Ponting was another player who could do this as well. But I really like a player who can pull really, really straight, like without it being like a slog or a flat bat. Couchar. Hopefully I got that slightly right. Do you use financial models for betting markets? Modeling the risk return of batters. This has become the betting podcast. Score and control percentage is easy, but not bowlers. The wicket taking length depends on pitches. Any suggestions? I have never made a betting model. So I just use at the moment. I'm not betting like a huge amount of money. So I'm not trading like tens of thousands of pounds or hundreds of thousands of pounds. I think that's when you go to these sorts of models. I'm more looking at, are there things that are happening at the moment that have not been factored into the market? So I'm trying to think of, USA Namibia game that was on, that is just, not you, sorry, who was it? USA UAE game that was on. So I was watching that while I was working out earlier. And I was watching that and I was like, so America were about 100 for three, I think, roughly. And they weren't going particularly quickly. But every time they middled a ball, it went for four, right? And the two players at the crease were set by this stage. That and I don't know what the odds were, but it was like, well, that is a bet on the USA based on this is a very flat pitch. You should be able to make a lot of runs from it, and you'll be able to catch up at the end. That's the sort of stuff that I'm looking at when I'm trading a game, is those sorts of things. And you get some right, you get some wrong, and occasionally you get something really, really right. I think I make the majority of my money probably on games where I can tell when the air's gone out of the ball in a T20 game. And also maybe understanding the associate teams better would be another thing. So yeah, the models, I haven't got to that, but I've been talking to people about building models, but it isn't something that I've had to worry about at the moment. I'm winning, so it's fine. Maybe if I start to lose or someone, you know, invests a lot of money in me or gets me involved with the syndicate, then I'll have to worry about that sort of stuff. I think that's it for all the super chats. There's just a couple of other chats that I want to get to. I think AB asked this the other day, when and why did umpires stop bending? I think the bending was more to do with the back foot no ball law, is my memory. And then so some umpires who were involved with both continued to do it. One of the reasons they moved to the front foot no ball was possibly to do this. It's terrible for umpires' backs, but it does help for LBWs. But I don't think it worked as well in the future. And Hypercourse had Millie and Jessica's parents, Joe and Robbie Kerr, both played for Wellington, and their grandfather, Bruce Murray, played for New Zealand. So that was when we were talking about before of the three generations. I knew that Amelia Kerr and Bruce Murray had played, but I wasn't sure about the parents. I knew they were involved in cricket, but I wasn't quite sure. But yeah, so that's there must be another family out there that maybe we haven't quite come across at the moment. And Hypercourse says, Sonny Villian, I think Villian is how you pronounce it, isn't it? Played Test and ODIs for South Africa in 2000. They won a javelin silver medal. I didn't know that one. That's awesome. That's one that has got... I mean, there's a lot of... I know a lot of the Australian ones, but there is a lot of people who do play multiple sports. Asif Karim represented Kenya in cricket and at the Davis Cup. Obviously, there's more than Ash Barty stories, another one, but there's a few like that. But yeah, there is a few others. I'm sure if I went through them, it's one of those things that's like, there are some people who just remember it. It just doesn't matter that much to me, so I kind of ignore it. Chewy, which I'm probably still mispronouncing. Maybe you can ask a tail ender to just practice and master the art of dead batting. Given the nature of modern tests, where batting gets easier after a ball is 40 overs. It's always been easy to bat after 40 overs. The issue here is that it's not actually particularly easy to dead bat if you're not already a very good batter. So if you go through the hit, so Matthew Hoggard Matthew Hoggard is someone who was probably one of the great dead batters. If you go back, he had no backlift at all, right? And so I'd done a deep dive into his batting. And when you go into it, I'm trying to see if I've got it here. So he played 92 innings as a dead batter and spent a lot of time working on it in the nets, is what I was told. And he faced 22 balls per test, right? And I would say he's one of the best dead batters I have seen. And Jason Gillespie, slightly more technically correct, but again, not a big backlift or anything like that. Obviously good enough to make a double hundred at a certain time. But yeah, very rarely played shots at all. And let's see if I can find his batting, right? And he certainly was another player in that era, especially the Australians really worked quite a lot on batting. Even if you account for the fact that he made 200 in one innings and faced, oh God, a lot of balls in that innings, he still only faces 40 balls per innings. And if you take out the Bangladesh one, I would assume it probably changes quite a bit. Dead batting doesn't really work. And I've said this a lot when people go, oh, I should be more defensive. Being defensive doesn't really work in test level, because if you're defensive, what you're saying to Vernon Philander or Mohammad Asif or Jasprit Bumrah or Stuart Clarke or Rangana Harath or whoever, you now get to bowl 24 balls at me. If the best bowlers in the world bowl 24 balls at you, you're probably going to go out, right? And so what you see with Pujara and Watling, who we talked about before, Dravid, those sorts of guys, is they are not dead batters. They are brilliant defensive batters, which is, it's very rare. You don't get that many. If dead batting really worked, we would have a lot more test batters with like over 5,000, or let's say over 3,000 runs in test cricket with a strike rate of under 35, right? And let's just do this live, right? So if we look at 3,000 runs in test cricket as a minimum, and we look at a strike rate, if we look at strike rates of those players, where are we here? So batting strike rate of under 35. I can move it to 40 as well. Like, there aren't that many under 40, which is kind of proving my point. But if we go under 35, we don't have anyone with an average over 35 with that record that we have ball-by-ball data on, like that we have a lot of data on. So the only guy that I know with 3,000 runs with a strike rate of under 35 is Grant Flower. Right, these players don't exist. So let's move that. Let's do batting strike rate, and we move that up to 40, which is, I think, fine. So a batting strike rate of less than 40 should open this up a little bit more for us. Just trying to see if there's any. So Atherton, we don't have all of his balls, but we have a fairly high section of his balls. I've got Shastri listed here as another one. And Jimmy Adams, right? Those are the only ones I have in my system. Now, I don't have all the ball-by-ball data, and I'm assuming in the old days there's a couple of more, because there does feel to me, I know Charles Davis has done more of the ball-by-ball stuff on the older players, but I think there are a couple of players that we have that. Boycott has the strike rate of 35 as Varun has just put up here, and John Wright as well, but we don't have their full careers. So we don't actually know if that's their legitimate or not. So if you look at the players that we know, it doesn't exist. So this kind of player that we've all built into our head really doesn't exist. I think traditionally it did when pitchers were more favored towards bowlers. And so there was certainly a time when I think that did exist a lot more. After World War II, I don't know if there's that many players who have ever done it realistically. And in the last 50 years, while we've been counting these stats, right, we have pretty much in the last 50 years, we have a good idea. Well, last 40 years, we have a good idea. A lot of test players have played, and what we call a slow test player. So if you look at Pujara again, and Pujara is an interesting one because my memory is he's got a slow strike rate away from home compared to at home, right? So his strike rate at home is 49, which is just normal. Away from home, it's 39.97. So right on the cusp. So even if the most defensive that you've ever seen Pujara, right, you're still seeing that. You're still seeing him at that level. Even in Australia, when we talk about him blocking, it's 37. There aren't many dead batters. It's just not a thing that exists. And Pujara is exactly the same as anyone else. He knows that he has to just get off strike sometimes. Anyway, last question. Abhishek says, are you going to Australia to cover India Australia? I don't have a sponsor on the channel at the moment. We are negotiating with a couple of sponsors at the moment, about two or three sponsors. If everyone came on board, there, because I've actually got another project in Australia that I sort of need to get out there for. If everything came on board, I would pop out to Australia for the Perth test and the Adelaide test. Although it's getting really late and I don't know what accreditation is going to be like now and how many Indian journalists are going to be going out there and everything. But yes, if everything goes exactly the way I want, I would love to go to Perth, Canberra and Adelaide for the 2.5 weeks or whatever it is for those two tests and the tour game. I don't know now. If you would have asked me a month ago, I'd be like, I'm pretty sure I'm going to do this. Right at the moment, I'm not as sure. But I would love to do it. The biggest problem is that, you know, since COVID, I've gone from literally before COVID traveling like 100 days a year, 200 days a year, even 250 days a year to literally not traveling at all. And I don't think I ever want to go back to the massive tour demands that I used to have when I was younger. You know, I've got three children now. I really like working from home. I actually like controlling my content a lot more. Sometimes when you're on the road, even when you have great ideas, you can't do it because you're bouncing from a bus to a train to a plane and trying to find food and all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of things I like about, you know, being at home and covering cricket, but I don't meet anyone anymore, right, in the game. And so unless some random player sends me a DM somewhere, like I don't have the same contacts that I used to have. A lot of my contacts are now coaches because like those are the people I met in the last 15 years when I was on the road. But also I just like watching the game from the ground. Like I get something else from that and it changes things. And, you know, it's at home, right? Like I would like to be able to go home. Like I'll nip into Melbourne for a couple of days as well on that kind of tour. So I would say at the moment, I'm like a 40% chance of making it, but I certainly won't be doing the whole series. But if I can whip out for a couple of tests, that would be sensational. But yeah, we're kind of in between sponsorship at the moment, but we're meeting some people, but you know, goes back to Ranjeev's thing of like who we're meeting and how these things go through. So thank you very much to everyone. Oh, wait, just Hypercore says, according to Charles Davis's one, the slowest going batsman of all time, the only batter with 2,000 runs at under a 30 strike rate is Trevor Bailey. He was an all-rounder. Kind of goes back to tell you my overall point. But thank you to everyone for hanging around, and we will see you again very soon. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.